After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nichtern. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle. Facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit eherenownetwork.com/David.
Thank you, Duncan, for joining us on this podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And the topic is one of the chapter titles of the new book, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, which you chose, which is the topic of success and contentment.
Yes.
So that's interesting because you're operating in a world that these issues are relevant, right?
Yes.
So I'm just going to throw it to you. What do you make of that distinction?
Well, because, you know, I picked that chapter because I used to be the talent coordinator of the Comedy Store, mm-hmm. and which means this is when Mitzi Shore was still running the show there, and I was the second to last talent coordinator that worked under her, and I would say I was the last talent coordinator to work under her when she was all there, because she had Parkinson's, and mm-hmm. so there was some, you know, the things that go along with that, and just getting old in general. But I was mostly her assistant, but what it did is it gave me a kind of chance to connect with every, like at the Comedy Store, all these various levels of comedian, from like open micer to super successful comedian. And that's where I made friends with Joe Rogan, who became my mentor in comedy, and then and started taking me on the road. And there are all these encounters with success. And the encounters with success in the beginning, I was encountering it with a mind where this was when TV still meant something. The internet was there, and there was like this was even before Dane Cook started using MySpace to promote his comedy shows. So in those days, if you wanted to make money as a stand-up comic, there was no option to have a successful YouTube video or a successful podcast. Comedians would actually go on the road, and they would have placed on tables cards, and people would write their phone numbers down. And they would get these mailing lists, phone number lists. That was what you would have to do. A stand-up comic not getting on TV would become what was called like a road dog, is what it was called. And basically you would do morning radio. You would hopefully get booked at these clubs. And you would have to do almost like a political campaign for your career. And over time, if you were lucky, you might get crowds come and show up. So that was the time period when that was the very end of that time period. And in that time period, getting on TV meant everything for a comedian, because suddenly you were exposed to like the markets, and then people would come to see you at clubs. And that means you could book time at clubs, because what club is going to hire a comedian that isn't going to have a draw outside of the draw of the club? It's called having a draw.
Sure.
So for me, running into a comedian at that. Now you run into someone who's been on TV. It's like we've all been on TV at this point now. It's like what Andy Warhol's like. Literally, almost every single one of us at this point has been on TV. It seems like, but at the time, I can remember getting on the phone with the Randy Sklar. These are a comedian duo, and he had just been on some TV show. I can't remember what it was. It was just a TV show, and I said to him, "How does it feel to have made it?" And I meant it. I really meant it. Wow. And he said to me, "What are you talking about?" I think he thought I was being sarcastic, like I was messing with him. Like he didn't realize I'd just come from a liberal arts school in North Carolina. And in my mind, this guy had made it. And he's like, "Duncan, we have not made it. This is not making it." I mean, I don't think I even, at the time, I thought like people on TV are getting paid instantly hundreds of thousands of dollars. You're getting, you know, some kind of SAG fee, maybe $500 or $600 per appearance, if that, you know. But in my mind, it was just the most incredible thing. And so that's when I was like, oh, okay. And for him, where he's at, is it sounded in his voice like it was almost like he was, I'm not going to say failing necessarily, but just he wasn't where he wanted to be.
So in your mind, he was successful. In his mind, he was not successful.
Exactly. Here's another example of that. There was a comedian, Freddie Soto, the comedian who got me into doing stand-up, who was the one who like encouraged me the first time to be a comic. And so there's the Comedy Store van. And the second job I had there was to be the runner. And the runner rides around in the Comedy Store van and essentially drives Mitzi to appointments. Go get me a cow tongue sandwich, honey. You have to go get this weird food for her. And it was just in the old days, this was considered a really great job for a comedian because she would pick comedians to do it. And it meant she thought you were funny and she was going to start training you to be a comedian. Now, this was no longer the case.
Like an apprentice.
Like an apprentice.
Right.
That was the sell. That was like the way they hooked you.
Yeah.
Reality, you're riding around in a van, you know, driving a woman to her appointments, but then and you would think that, how am I learning how to be a comedian? And yet, actually, she would say stuff to you during that time, you know, but she would never let you think she thought you were a comedian because that would ruin it, you know, but like, anyway, the point is Freddie, as he's training me to be the runner, because he was the runner before, he had me drive him to a UPS commercial audition for UPS. And I remember sitting outside in the van as he runs in there to do this audition, thinking to myself, man, one day I'm going to go on UPS commercial auditions. And I was excited about that idea. Like, I wonder if I'll ever get to that level.
And how old were you at that point?
I was like mid-20s. Uh-huh. You know, I'd just gotten out of college, but I took some time off before college. So, in my mind, that was success. And then, anyway, the point is, every single level of success, my encounter with people who are successful, they never really seem to think they're successful.
You mean as you met people who actually were kind of well-known and successful, they still didn't feel that they didn't have the contentment?
I've had conversations with... There's actually a phenomena that I have not experienced yet that you hear about. And it used to be it's a Tonight Show phenomenon. So have you ever heard of this? The Tonight Show depression?
Oh, that you got on the show, but then you were...
You get on the show.
Yeah.
You finally get on the Tonight Show.
Right.
You do your stand-up. You get off stage. You go back into your green room. Maybe you sign some forms. You get in your car. You drive home. Maybe you got some texts, some contact from people. You still have to go to bed. Now what? You go to bed, you got to wake up in the morning. And it's a comedian's report, many of them. This kind of terrible depression sinks in. Another version of it is on the road. You have a great show.
Right, sure.
You kill. People are coming up to you after the show. Oh, so funny, so funny. Then you go back to the hotel. Forensic Files is on. You lay in bed, jerk off, order a sandwich.
Yeah.
You're in your boxer shorts. Now what? And
so it's like postpartum depression.
Yes.
Very similar.
Yes. Right? And it's insidious because mm-hmm. It's cliche, it's insidious, but yeah, it's a, having, you know, you witness these comedians and they are incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking some of them millionaires, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands of dollars at the very least. And you sit with them sometimes and they are so depressed and so unhappy and so paranoid and so miserable. And we hear about it all the time.
Right.
They die. They overdose on pills. They shoot themselves. They get in a drunk car accident. They leave behind a trail of like children mm-hmm. with no parents. And yet, if the world saw it, they would think, oh, success.
Sure.
They've got it all. Mm-hmm. They're famous. They've got the coolest job on earth. But they're dying on couches at friends' homes on pills. Freddie Soto, who got me into comedy, died of a drug overdose. They're asphyxiating on their own puke. And so,
now you entering that realm, which you live in that world, right?
Yeah.
By choice, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And also by creative bent, which is part of what the book's about, is that your creativity has led you to want to express yourself in this way, right?
Yeah, it's still
natural.
It feels good.
Yeah,
I love it.
And how do you kind of calibrate your own sense of success then after having seen what you just described?
Well, I am, my main job is, you know, you just taught me something that I didn't even realize I was doing, that Trungpa Rinpoche told you, which is hopelessness. And when it comes to stand-up comedy, I have found that state to be my dearest friend. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean a depressed form of hopelessness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just mean, I love doing it. I get on stage and brings me joy. Mm. And that is what I like to do. I have a podcast, so my podcast is my job. It sustains me. So I feel that I have success now. Like I know that I have success. I have
my... In your own terms, you feel successful. If somebody said, are you successful at what you're trying to do? You'd say yes.
Absolutely.
Succeed. And would you say you're content also?
Well, the reason I'm content
right.
is not because of the success, but that's not to say that the success doesn't take a... The success creates a space where you can practice in a unique way. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't have this... the practice I've been learning from the Ram Dass retreats, I don't know if I would think of myself as successful. I might be sick mm-hmm. With greed mm-hmm. or who knows what else. So yeah, I feel successful. The reason I feel successful is more because I have like a community of friends that I'm connected to, and that makes me feel very successful. Mm-hmm. But the other, it's hard to say because like, I want to say, you know, you end up sounding like a real fucking high road and son of a bitch when you're like, it's not the fact that I'm supporting myself through my art that's making me happy. That's definitely part of it. But,
well, that's the point of view of the book, is that you can integrate these three things. That's the whole intention of the book. You're a creative person and you're expressing yourself. You've chosen to bring that to your livelihood as
yeah.
opposed to as a hobby on the side.
Yeah.
So you've had to learn how to do the business of comedy.
Yeah.
Make deals and get paid and hire people you need to support you. And you have some kind of well-being that you're cultivating throughout the whole process.
That's right.
That's exactly, you know, if there's any aspiring comics out there, it's like this is, we're trying to talk to them about this possibility.
Well, let me tell you something Rogan said to me once. Mm-hmm. Joe Rogan is one of the most generous people I've ever met in my life. And one of the things that he does is he will, if he thinks you're funny, even if you're not at the time, which you know, I don't think I was when he saw it. I just got lucky. He was in the back of the room. He saw me tell a joke that killed. I got off stage. He hugged me. He's like, man, you're funny. And that's Rogan telling you you're funny. And you're like, oh, shit. Whoa. And then he starts inviting me on the road with him. And then he became my friend. But he was also my mentor for a long time.
You mean as an opening act? Or?
As an opening for Joe. You get to open for Rogan. I've watched him do this now with...
Wow. So that's generosity right there. That was very generous.
Generous for me, especially. Like, I have this satanic puppet act I was doing that was... This is when he was on Fear Factor. So the people coming to see him, they weren't like... These were like people who liked Fear Factor. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily Rogan fans. Rogan's comedy is raw and hilarious. And like, mm-hmm. you know, people coming from TV, they're just like, what the fuck are we seeing here? And like, mm-hmm. he thought it was so funny that I was doing the satanic puppet act in front of these people who were just horrified. Like, some of them were like just scared, some of them confused. But he thought that was just hilarious, and he was letting me do that. And he would just say, just do it. Just do it. Do whatever you want. Just bomb. I don't care. Just do it. He was really, he's a great mentor. But I remember mm-hmm. He took me to a Fear Factor, some kind of Fear Factor banquet. Mm-hmm. Now, this is when I'm dead broke. So getting invited to a banquet for a starving comedian is really great because there's food. Because you're going to be eating really good food. It means you're going to get a salad. You're going to get maybe like a steak, or there's going to be actual food instead of the shit you've been eating. Like when you're a starving comic, man, I remember like having friends come over and they open the refrigerator. Two comedians came over because I used to live right by the Comedy Store, and they open the refrigerator and I have cheese, just packaged cheese. And one of them goes, you have cheese? And they start eating the cheese. Like they're refugees or something. Like, we were broke. And so I'm at this banquet, and there's this great food, infinite booze, infinite wine, infinite food. And like Fear Factor shit, like an aquarium with those fish that you could stick your hand in, it's sticky. Anyway, this is what he said to me. He said, success, it's not like it makes you happy or not happy. He said, it stops the clock from ticking. He's like, right now you have a ticking clock in your head. You're worried about your bills. You're worried about your rent. You don't know if you're going to be able to pay for this or pay for that. There's always this ticking clock. I got to figure out a way to make this much money for the rent. I got to figure it out. He's like, when you get a lot of success, that clock stops ticking. Mm-hmm. So now you don't have to, that constant gnawing anxiety that is the worry that you won't be able to make your bills or make your rent. That's true.
Right.
But then when that clock stops ticking,
yeah,
you realize there's a lot of other clocks.
The next ticking you hear is going to be a bomb.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You know, the other dimension that, you know, I thought of you in relation to the book is this sort of, in the creative chapters, we talk about daring. You know, wanting to that it takes some kind of leap actually to be creative. Have you found that to be true? Have you had to kind of leap over yourself in a way to
absolutely
to express yourself
absolutely
in an honest way?
100%. You have to. If you know, like certain things, certain jobs, like that are desirable jobs compared to other jobs. Right. If there wasn't that leap, everybody'd be doing it. If there wasn't like the leap of risk, it's like deep, treacherous risk and not like movie risk. You know, like in the movies, if you take the risk, if you take the big leap of faith, it always works out. You know, sure, maybe there's going to be some trouble along the way, but it always works out. And that's the movie leap of faith.
And what about the relationship between success and risk? Because that's a sort of interesting... you know, you get successful being a certain way, doing certain things, and then you go, well, I'm feeling like this other thing coming on here, but I might blow off my constituency.
Yeah, sure.
And I could see, you know, I also see that tension with people who are doing livelihood work and spiritual work. You go, well, maybe you need to, like, pull back from your success for a minute here and really do some deep practice, for example.
Right.
So a question of balance and priorities. So have you felt a tension between like, okay, I'm getting my, everybody thinks of me as this, like even here at this retreat, they think of you a certain way. You're fulfilling a certain role.
Yeah, sure.
Now, all of a sudden, you're turning into a contemplative in front of everybody's eyes.
Yeah.
You were the kind of sparky, kind of cynical, crusty, inquisitive, younger guy. And now you're sitting there kind of in a kind of contemplative space, you know?
Yeah, because you were being, because what happened was I realized that if you are a liar, it's not going to work out for you. So
period.
If you're a, and so when it comes to anything that you're doing, if you, and for me, what started happening was, oh yeah, okay, this stuff is actually not real. It not only is it real, it's vital. And then you realize like, oh, this is, if I start feigning disbelief in an attempt to seem cool, which is
feigning disbelief.
Yeah.
Usually people are feigning belief, right?
That's right.
Yeah. You have to feign disbelief. That's really funny.
Well, the person who called me on it originally was, what's his name? Lama Suryadas. Because I'd just done one of these things, and I was sitting up there, and I was trying to be as like fashionably cynical as I could be, to be like, you old, old crusty hippies with your crazy ideas, and it's a bunch of. I didn't say I was being respectful, but it was like playing the part of this of the jaded, cynical person. But inside, I was had already been having experiences and feelings and of connection and the beauty of the thing that weren't matching what I was saying on stage, and so. Lama Suryadas, it was a llama. He was in a Hawaiian shirt, man. You guys, you're tricky because you, from movies and stuff, we have this idea that you guys are going to look like something, out of Harry Potter or something, and when you're camouflaged in.
Yeah.
So a guy in a trained Buddhist teacher in a Hawaiian shirt comes up to me. He's like, might I offer some... may I offer some critique? Mm-hmm. And I was like, sure.
How he said it?
Yeah, it was very polite. He's like, do you mind if I offer some critique of what you're... It was very polite. And I was like, oh, yes, please. And he sits down. And he says, you know that thing you're doing? Where you're like... He was talking about the skepticism and stuff. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know what that's going to look like in 10 years? It's going to look like when you see videos of hippies in the 60s going, groovy, man. And what he was saying is like, you're being fashionable. Mm-hmm, you're trying to be cool. You're trying to be like, what is the current way to be, which is like, let's all like roll our eyes at this shit and like be super cynical. And that's not who you are. Mm-hmm. And that was when he said that to me, and I realized like, oh man, you just opened the door and a lion walked into your... You just let a lion in that was wearing a lion in a Hawaiian shirt. And it was what you were talking about, wrathfulness. Mm-hmm. And then he said, something on the lines of, if you keep pretending like that, it can kill you. And I know what he meant. And it can kill you. I mean, it's so unethical.
Yeah.
It's so, the karma is so bad. Like, it's so disgusting to be that level of a sellout that you would rather have some jaded audience, I guess, appreciate you as some kind of...
With a big paycheck.
Well, yeah. Yeah. You would exactly...
All the accoutrement,
Well, I mean, it's satanic, isn't it? I'm going to make a shit ton of money by telling people not to believe something that is giving me great happiness in life. Mm-hmm. What could be more horrific than that? Mm-hmm. Absolutely unethical and not fit and completely antithetical to the idea that I'm going to be this skeptical person. A scientist reports results and also reports this is why the results may not be real, which I'm completely willing to do. So anyway, and also the other thing that I found though is from that, whatever you want to call it, the honesty, which can a lot of times you have to overcome a lot of fear to do that. It's the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. It's not as though now everyone's like, shut the fuck up, hippie. It's like that. I fabricated that audience. I don't know that that audience exists. I sit on my podcast sometimes and I'll be apologizing to someone who I think listens to my podcast. And it's like, you woo-woo hippie person, why do you say this shit? And I'll talk to that person like, look, I know this seems ridiculous to you. And then I realized, oh, I fabricated that being.
Mm-hmm. Well, so looking at the other, you know, turning it around the other way, you know, you're saying that the edge, a fabricated edge, is not going to serve you. In other words, even though it might appear to be sexy or appealing, you know, like, this guy's edgy, you know?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, and we're agreeing that fundamentally you don't want to fabricate that edge, but then there's a real edge, which is sort of an essential ingredient of both creativity and spiritual practice, where you kind of go more towards the edge of the experience to uncover that which may not be obvious.
Yeah.
Or that which may be covered by habitual kind of patterns of all kinds. So that's the sort of flip side of that edge. That edge is kind of, how do you see that edge as a positive element in kind of in your creative pursuit and in your spiritual journey?
It is. Okay. I can answer that question. And the mm-hmm. best way to answer it is this. You know, I love, we just had this great conversation about wrathfulness and, mm-hmm. and it not being like the way you, when you hear it, you think of someone screaming or something or throwing shit at you. But what it really is someone going right to the heart of the thing. Mm-hmm. So there was a time when I was doing comedy and I was lying to myself about a lot of different things. I was in a kind of a difficult relationship that I was prolonging and shouldn't have been, essentially. And this comedian, Jay London, who is a one-liner comedian, he got on Last Comic Standing. I think he won it. But he's kind of like this shamanic figure. Literally, he's like, you just see him and he's a shamanic being. And we're at the improv, he just walks up to me. And he's like, how you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing great. Big smile on my face. I was miserable. And he looks at me and he goes, you know, if you're not telling the truth to yourself in your life, it bleeds out on stage.
Wow.
And it hurt so bad because I knew what he meant. It's like, man, this is the audience. It's a group mind. Mm-hmm. You think they can't sniff out your self-deception? Please, you're not fooling anyone, you know? And so the way it applies to comedy is if you can get your day-to-day life on the beam, so to speak, you know.
So that's a voice for like having a balanced existence and still being successful
absolutely.
And funny. You think it's all possible to do all of it?
Well, so, I think
the edge to me is where you think maybe it's not possible. Maybe I have to give something up, or maybe I have to change something, or shift, or you know, it was very intriguing to me to watch you know the Gary Shandling, doc, because I felt like and you know I know a lot of comedian friends.
I do know that,
you know, and so this is an intriguing area for me. I love comedy. I love to laugh. I like to, you know, kid around. And I like the art of it and the artifice of it and the commerce of it. I'm intrigued by the whole thing. I live in a nearby colony, which is called the music world.
Yes.
You know, the musician's world. They have the very similar
very
things,
similar.
But some differences. So, you know, what would happen if you were true but not funny? For example, there's an edgy question.
If you were true but not funny?
Yeah, you said it's important to be truthful.
Yeah.
It's important to be honest, emotionally honest. And if that led you to a place where you were not funny, what would happen? Which path would you choose?
Well, I don't think...
Because in the Gary show, Gary Shandling documentary, I felt like they teased that edge there in a very intriguing way. As he was getting older and sicker and things like that, I think he was asking deeper questions about life and so forth. And maybe the short hop is to get a joke out of it. But maybe you have to skip that to get into the meat of it.
Tell you what I did.
Yeah.
I stopped doing comedy until I felt like I was funny, until I felt like I was back on the beam again. I mean, I just stopped.
He sort of did too, right? Didn't he?
Yeah, I think he did, but he was like massively successful but for me it was like, I mean, I'm a mid-level podcaster, mm-hmm. but my feeling was with it is like, well, you know, right now I don't really like what I'm saying up here. It doesn't really feel like it's reflecting how I think in the world. And I didn't, so I just stopped. And then, and now I've started doing it again and I love it. But my feeling with it is number one, very important. The two are not mutually, like, I think that you can always be, that whole superstitious fear that comedians have that they're funny is going to go away.
Uh-huh. If they get kind of
always
sane or whatever, right?
But I think this is just the way, like, you know, what happens? Mara, the Lord of the Earth, appears to Buddha. And there's the three temptations, the fireballs, the daughter uh-huh. of Mara, the question. Uh-huh. Why do you deserve to be the Buddha, you know? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I think walking down this path, this thing will appear.
Mm-hmm. The Maras.
Yeah. And I'll try to tell you that for you to continue down this path, you must give up the thing you love to do the most, whatever it may be.
Like Job in the Bible, right?
Yeah.
Sort of that idea.
And then what happens is you realize that you, when you give it up, paradoxically, is the moment you've started doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like the moment you're like, okay, sure. All right, bye-bye comedy.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that anymore. Bye-bye comedy. Mm-hmm. Then you start getting funny because this stupid, weighty, dumb idea of what you thought comedy was mm-hmm. based on seeing other people and what mm-hmm. you thought was cool and all this crap,
mm-hmm.
you just let go of all the things that were holding you back.
This would be an interesting question to ask your friend Joe, who's a fighter. But I trained a meditation teacher in Japan, and she actually is a translator for UFC. So I've seen on TV with between these huge fighters, she's, you know, Japanese woman. But she started to teach meditation at some of the training places. And one of the fighters came up to her and said, you know, I like this kind of settled quality and I like this practice. I'm a little concerned that I might lose my edge and not want to fight.
Yeah.
And you could pass that question by with a kind of glib answer, but it's something very deep in it, actually. You know, if it wasn't for the Maras, what would you be doing, if anything?
Mm.
So it's, you know, of course there's things that are said about this, that what would occur is without the Maras being the motivating force is more spontaneous, more organic, more filled with wisdom and compassion just by nature. That's the logic of it. But still, that's not somebody being at the edge of saying, I'm, you know, and there is in our tradition a lot of giving up in very famous stories about famous yogis like Milarepa and, you know, and Gampopa and these, you know, who had to give up whole things, including financial resources, including opportunities, including relationships.
Yeah.
You know, so if we look at the edge of that question, where does it take you?
What do you mean, giving up?
Yeah, like where does surrender or letting go or giving up take you if it takes you into new territory? Totally new territory. Completely unfamiliar territory.
If you're an artist, I think if you're an artist or whatever, a cartographer maybe is another way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get off the map. No one gives a shit. Like if like some, you know, if like, think about that.
Yeah.
A cartographer meeting.
Yeah.
And there's like a cartographer in the meeting who just goes to places that have already been mapped and redraws those places and shows the other cartographers his maps. Who cares?
Right.
We have these maps, detailed GPS aerial maps.
Right.
Who cares? About your dumb maps. Like, there's a million maps.
I do when I'm going to Italy, for example. I do care.
You care about the maps.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the maps have been drawn of Italy.
Right, so...
No one's doing a new map of Italy.
Yeah, right.
And if they do, it's the wrong map of Italy, if it's interesting, probably, right? So it's like, who... So the thing is like, if this... By some great fortune, the universe comes to you and invites you to step off the map.
Mm-hmm.
What could be better than that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, so now I want to just tie one more thing together, and then I think we're kind of good exploring this. Is now this notion of contentment is a very interesting idea from a spiritual point of view or a materialistic point of view.
Yeah.
Like when you know somebody who has deep contentment, they're satisfied. Now, what does the Buddha say? Nobody's satisfied in this particular realm of samsaric existence where we find ourselves. Even the gods are not satisfied.
Yeah.
Even the people who've made it are not satisfied. Even the people who are drenched in bliss are not really satisfied.
Yeah.
Because they want that result to happen again and again.
Yeah.
So how would you equate contentment, which arguably is, I think, a powerful, positive thing to think about.
Absolutely.
With this edge that we're talking about, and kind of like part of that edge is never being content. I'm not content with the map of Italy. I'm not content with doing that again. So is it possible to have your edge and be content, is what I'm asking.
You know, man, when I get content,
yeah,
I'll answer your question. But I want to say this to you.
You do seem more content than you did 2 years ago, by the way.
I feel good.
Yeah, your energetic is more content, don't you think?
Yes, yes. I mean, the feeling is, I mean, I think contentment is a pretty edgy thing by itself.
Mm.
If we're in a world where many people are completely freaked out and dissatisfied,
right,
and you run into an authentically content person,
mm,
and you see that, just that alone is a pretty intense thing to run into.
Right.
And for a lot of people, that's like slamming into a wall or something like that. And I think actually Meister Eckhart talked about how, he used different words than contentment, but I think he did talk about how just, I think he used Christian terms for this, but I think just having turned inward to the divine inside and being content with that, that can make certain people around you feel like they're on fire.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what's edgier than that?
Wow. You know, I think that's a good moment to end on.
Cool, awesome.
Very clear moment. And thank you so much, Duncan, for participating in this conversation. It's part of our ongoing thread of talking about these kind of things together.
Thanks for teaching me how to meditate.
Okay, my pleasure. Okay, thank you.